second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
Hello, Aaron.
Hello, Bill.
Hi, my name is Bill Cundiff. And,
what do you have for us today, Bill?
Well,
want me to help you do the commercial? I know you like it when
You know, I'm going to just try to freelance it, if that's okay with you, Aaron. Our sponsor this hour is Pap A Machinery. They're our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. And right now you can go down and get yourself a great deal on a John Deere tractor or mower or whatever John Deere product you're looking for. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake. And they got great financing, great inventory levels right now. So go down and see them. Spring's right around the corner. Or you can give them a call. The phone number is 530-226-9226. Or you can catch them on the web at papamachinery.com.
Ta-da!
There you go.
And Shasta Lake City is a budding metropolis, by the way. It's not a city.
Yes, it is.
There you go.
Yeah.
Just wanted to be clear about that. So our guest today.
I like how you said budding.
But I know. I'm glad somebody got the joke. I was having a good time all by myself over here. So we have Officer Joe and Kathy with us because, of course, we're talking about our favorite topic. Nope, not national security. Nope, not the MoveOn.org email that I got last week that said that that the Democrats weren't getting any donations since Joe Biden got elected because nobody had any money, which I frankly thought was hilarious. Not that. It was something else. And we have Dr. Bertha Madras. She's our hostage on the telephone. She is a professor of psychobiology in the Department of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, amongst other things. And I do hope you will go online and look at all the great information we have on there. And Officer Joe has his hand up here in the you have the talking stick. You want the talking stick?
Dr. Madras, if you could get the – I'm sitting in the corner like in a dunce chair, and I have my hand high in the air because I get the chance to talk to you, and I just want you to know I absolutely respect you and love all the training that you do for citizens in the United States. So back to marijuana. One of the things that you talked about –
foolishness is over. Foolishness is over now. Ding!
One of the things you talked about was a classical sign of addiction, which is – the body's response to marijuana and its ability to need more and more to get the same high. And that's a classic, that's one of the classic signs of addiction. Could you address how does marijuana actually work on the brain and talk about metabolites and maybe tell us what those are, where they stay in the body, how long they stay in the body, those kind of things?
Well, what is fascinating about marijuana is that no matter how much we think we know how it works, we keep still finding new things about what it does to the brain. The simplest,
new stuff not to like.
The simplest explanation is that the marijuana signals are abnormal. They're not the normal signals that the brain produces with its own cannabinoid system. So there is cannabinoids. There are cannabinoids produced by the brain. They target a site called the CB1 receptor. That receptor translates the signals and sets off a whole shopping list of events in your brain. Now, marijuana looks like some of your own chemical signals, but it's not identical. Because it's not identical, it triggers different signals. It triggers signals that are longer, that are stronger, and sets off a whole cascade of events in your brain that is abnormal. So what happens? One of the first things that happen to the brain is that the so-called CB1, the cannabinoid receptor, the target of marijuana, goes way down. It decreases tremendously. What are the consequences of it decreasing? It means that the brain can no longer respond to THC in the same way because its target is disappearing. Let's say you have a key that you put in a lock, and each time you keep using the key, the lock shrinks and shrinks until there is no longer a place for that key to go. So marijuana causes that target to slowly gets lower and lower, and as a result of it, you need more and more marijuana to produce the same effect. you've got to flood the brain with more and more to produce the feelings and sensations that you want to get from using the drug. The tolerance is one of the examples in which marijuana has an addictive potential. Another one is withdrawal. Yes, especially with high-potency marijuana, you can suffer a very severe withdrawal, depending on how much you've used and how frequently you've used. Now, a long time ago, with very low-potency drugs, there wasn't as much withdrawal. There was withdrawal, but not to the same extent. But because the brain is hyper-adapted now to these very potent forms of marijuana, the withdrawal becomes more and more prominent. And it happens in about 30 to 40% of people who are addicted to the drug. That percent may get up higher, depending on whether or not more and more people are going to use higher and higher doses. And that withdrawal includes insomnia, restlessness, irritability, stress reaction, loss of appetite. It can also involve stomach cramps. It can involve a few of the withdrawal symptoms, but milder than opioid withdrawal. So there is a real physical as well as psychological spectrum of withdrawal symptoms after heavy use of marijuana. And another symptom of addiction is craving the drug, because people who undergo withdrawal, if they have sleep problems, if they have anxiety, they crave marijuana to try to alleviate the symptoms of withdrawal. And some people think that's one of the big drivers of using. It's not merely to recapture that old that old high, but also to relieve the symptoms of withdrawal that have been produced.
That makes sense.
Is there
you, just before we go to the next part, if you could move your microphone just a tiny bit, because we're getting a little bit of over whatever.
Is this better?
That's terrific.
When you say you need more and more to get the effect that they're looking for, in higher doses, I'm sure your body is, there's other areas of your brain that are probably going to suffer because of the higher levels of THC. Is there any research done on that? It's like with an alcoholic, you know, they got to drink more and more alcohol to get the buzz, but a side effect is it eats their liver up. Is there anything that...
Well, as I said, we are just beginning to compare low and high doses.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of basic science, it's very hard to do these experiments in living people because you can't extract a piece of brain and look at it. You
can only look at brain.
it's what I would say highly unethical.
except you know, when you drive around, I'm pretty sure there are those experiments going on somewhere.
Yeah.
I saw some of them last night on the highway.
But psychologically, though, with higher doses, as they consume higher and higher doses of the drug, they're getting the buzz they're looking for. But is the brain reacting negatively as well?
Yes. So there is very strong evidence that the higher doses confer greater psychosis.
Okay.
So that's obvious. I mean, that's a clear one, and that's getting, you know, Robin Murray, whom you mentioned, and his wife, Marta DeForti, they published a beautiful study in 11 different sites showing that, and they focus particularly on Paris, London, and Amsterdam, and they showed that if a person uses daily or more frequently than daily and uses very high doses, their risk for developing psychosis just soars. It's sky high. So, in fact, in Amsterdam, they think about half of the cases of schizophrenia could be attributable at some point in time.
Hmm.
to very high potency marijuana.
So are they having higher instances of schizophrenia per capita than countries that don't?
In one or two European countries, they already have the data for that. We don't have it in the U.S. because we're far behind on studying marijuana and psychosis in the U.S.
Yeah, because we don't want anybody to know.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
If you don't study it, nobody will know. It's not hurting anyone.
Dr. Madras.
Well, you know, there should be routine testing for THC after every accident, after every fatality,
right,
after every episode of we're just not doing it in all the states, and that's a tragedy. We're not gathering the data that we desperately need. The Europeans are ahead of us this way. So that's a very important point. So psychosis clearly involves a rewiring of the brain, a rewiring of certain networks. But there's a new piece of data that has come out just in the past 2 years, partly from Yasmin Hurd's lab at Mount Sinai and our own, showing that high doses of THC confer an inflammatory response in certain parts of the brain, but only in adolescents and not adults. What is so fascinating about this?
Wait, say that one more time for people who missed it.
That at high doses, THC produces an inflammatory response in a very critical brain area. A brain area that is critical for thinking, for emotional responses to the world, and it's networked into a whole host of things that I won't get into. But this brain area is a critical one during adolescent brain development. And the inflammatory response is very highly correlated with high doses, and it's found primarily in the adolescent brain, not the adult brain.
Does that mean, Dr. Madras, that the developmental and neurological disorders and learning deficits in pediatric or young adults, that's the reason for it? Is this inflammatory response?
It could be the reason. What we are trying to do and what Yasmin Hurd's lab showed is that if after exposure during adolescence, in this case, it was animals, but they did the same test in human adults. After exposure during adolescence, but then no exposure thereafter. In other words, as adults, they don't use, but they only use during adolescence. They're finding in neuropsychological testing differences between adults that have been exposed during adolescence and not exposed. And some of those are that they are greater risk-seeking, they have greater impulsive behavior, but there are others as well. And we are beginning to think, and we just have a theory, but we don't have the data. So just bear with me for a moment. This brain region, besides being involved in stress response, in anger, in violence, in sleep disorders, and a whole host of things, is a critical brain area for facial recognition. And if a person is able to recognize not only faces, but identify expressions in faces, they can read another person. They can develop empathy for them. If another person is sad, they can see it, they can recognize it. Teens who use marijuana lose this capacity of being able to recognize emotions and being able to recognize faces and facial expressions. And one of the possibilities is that this inflammatory response, this is just a theory, it has no science yet behind it, but one of the theories is that the loss of this ability by this inflammation in this brain region could give rise to adolescents being unable to recognize and develop empathy towards other people with regard to fear, to sadness, and all that. Wow. And we don't know yet. We don't have the thread. But could this be a contributing factor to increased violence?
And anyone who's ever had a teenager in their house knows that they're already just so easy to work with. I can't even imagine the added difficulty in communication just with parents and their kids. We have to take a really quick break on that note, but I think we should, in the archive, maybe we'll take that like 5 minutes and just play it over and over and over and then go to the rest of it. That was really important. We'll be right back. I used to have that for a ringtone on my phone when he screamed, "I feel good." It was so much fun, especially if you were like in the doctor's office or church or something.
Yeah.
All right.
Dr. Mesh, I had a question, follow-up question on this psychosis. People that partake in high THC develop these psychotic issues, and what you were just talking about, not being able to recognize facial expressions. Is this something that is reversible in adolescence or adulthood? I mean, does it work differently for young people than older people, where their brains are already pretty much developed?
You know, it's an excellent question, of which we certainly don't have the final answers on that. And science never has final answers on anything. Let me just give you a quick rundown of marijuana and psychosis. The first published report of marijuana and psychosis came out of India in 1895.
Wow.
So that's, 200 years ago. And what it showed is a little bit less than 200, but a long time ago. What it showed is that people in the so-called insane asylums, which they called it then, there was a very high relationship between marijuana use and madness or schizophrenia or psychosis, whatever one labels it. And the association was much less with alcohol or with opioid use or with other drug use. So people concluded that there is something there about marijuana and psychosis. Then the Swedes, they have wonderful records on all their conscripts into the military. And they showed in just about a little over three decades ago, that people who had used marijuana before being conscripted into the Swedish Army, they had a higher prevalence of psychosis and schizophrenia than the recruits who had not used marijuana before being recruited in the Army. And so gradually this linkage began. And then a professor at Yale, D'Souza, he showed that if you give marijuana to otherwise completely normal people who have no evidence of psychosis, but you give them a reasonably high dose, they're going to develop symptoms that are characteristic of psychosis. So it began, the information began to gradually build up until now there is very strong relationship between the use of marijuana and the prevalence of psychosis and the dose-response relationship. In other words, the higher the dose, the greater the risk. And it seems that marijuana is even riskier for young people in terms of developing psychosis. And people who already have schizophrenia, which is a sort of a chronic version of psychosis, they are their symptoms are exaggerated with the use of marijuana. They get worse, and they have more rehospitalizations. So there is really, and the other interesting piece of information is that if people come in to the emergency department with a psychosis due to marijuana use that's precipitated by marijuana, their likelihood of converting to a chronic disease, if they continue to use, is somewhere between 25% and 40%, depending on the study. So basically, marijuana is a risk for psychosis, but if you remove the marijuana, the symptoms lessen. And the use of marijuana combined with psychosis is just going to make things worse. Now, if you develop psychosis and don't use marijuana thereafter, the likelihood is that you may not have another episode. But if you continue to use, you increase the risks.
Hmm. Okay. Dr. Madras, would it be safe to say that I've read studies out there that implicate cannabinoids and CBD in a diverse spectrum of congenital anomalies? In other words, we're not there to say permanent harm yet, although I think we should. But do you agree that there, people like Dr. Stuart Reese are showing that there's permanent changes now in
I'm very familiar with Stuart Reese's information. I don't think that the jury is out yet on making that a definitive conclusion. What we can say with the American study, the ABCD study, which is ongoing now, it's called the Adolescent Brain Development Study, Adolescent Brain and Cognitive Development. It's been funded for 10 years, and what they do is they start young people at the age of 9, and they're going to monitor them until they are post-adolescence. And what they have found, first and foremost, is that kids who were exposed to marijuana in the uterus by marijuana-using mothers, they have, at the age of 9, pre-psychotic symptoms. They have symptoms that suggest that they already have some form of abnormal thought processes. Now, whether or not that goes away, we do not know. But there is, with this study, a growing interest in what happens to young people if they use during adolescence or if they're exposed in utero. And so far, the data are not very very promising. It is not a wise thing to use either during adolescence or if you're pregnant. It really is quite disconcerting. The reversibility, we still don't know. We may have those answers in 5 or 10 years or so. The other thing in terms of congenital problems, you know, getting back to Stuart Reese's research, is that women who use marijuana, they are going to have a higher prevalence of premature births. They're going to have infants that are born of smaller birth size, infants with smaller head circumference, infants whose reactions you know, they're tested within the first few minutes. Their reactions are a little bit less than normal. So there are already signs that there are problems associated with being exposed in utero that I think are fairly well accepted. The congenital ones are correlations at this point, and I think we still have a way to go to say that that correlation is really causation.
Where does THC deposit itself in the body? It's a fat soluble drug, and can it be the problem we have with? By the way, let me give you some statistics for Northern California here. About 25% of our females, 15 to 24 childbearing age, are now using cannabis as a drug for morning sickness. About 95% of our high school age students have been exposed in some form to marijuana in the last month. It doesn't mean they used it, doctor, but they discussed it, they saw it used, or they used it themselves. It's the easiest drug to obtain in our Northern California counties, far easier than alcohol. And in our DUIs, we found that in surveys that almost 50% of the people were saying that, yes, they were reporting marijuana and alcohol use, which, as we both know, makes you higher and drunker. And we don't test for it in the state of California because the test costs $75. And if we arrest you for DUI alcohol, we've already convicted you under the law. So they don't bother to go after the THC component. Unless it's a fatal and they can determine that THC or that marijuana was used in that. What's your opinion as to where it's deposited in the body? And can you have reemergence of symptoms? Because a lot of people say, well, I got high 3 days ago, but now I'm not going to test positive. And if you test me and I still have THC in my system, you could falsely convict me of drunk driving 3 days later. What's your opinion about where it deposits itself, and does it have a cumulative effect in the body?
Yeah, those are excellent questions. So first of all, marijuana stays in the body for weeks because it deposits itself in strange places in the brain with certainty because it's very lipophilic, which means it loves fat. And the brain is a very fatty organ because the brain uses fat to insulate its wires that connect one nerve cell to another. It also is found in reasonably high concentrations in muscle, which is kind of strange because muscle is not fat, and yet there is a significant amount in muscle. It's found in liver. It's found in other organs. Now, when our society was using marijuana at about 3%, the 3% can clear. It will still take weeks to clear, but the amounts that will leach out of the brain and other parts of the body is low, and that's why people did claim that there's no such thing as marijuana withdrawal, because the marijuana just leaks out so slowly that you don't go into withdrawal. With extremely high doses, the brain is so neuroadapted that when it starts to clear out of the body, you still can have very robust symptoms. As to whether or not there is psychological impairment 1 day or 3 days or 10 days later, I can just say that there are some studies that say that you can be impaired significantly 1 day later. A person should not fly a plane if they took marijuana 24 hours before, and so on. And Canada trying to establish those regulations for people in the safety-sensitive jobs. But in research, generally speaking, the researchers will, if they want to do psychological testing, they will not test a person unless they have been cleared for at least 3 weeks, because they still feel there could be residual effects of their last dose up until 3 weeks. And in our lab, we have found, for example, that blood levels are not at all indicative of what's in the brain. The brain levels are about 2 to 3 times higher than what's in blood. So if a person tests less than 5 nanograms per ml in blood, their brains are still 12 to 15 nanograms. They're much higher than blood.
And I think it's interesting that we are worried about safety-sensitive jobs. I don't care if you work at McDonald's and you operate the fryer. You drove there.
Yep.
So, I mean, honestly, this affects everybody. These people are on the roadways.
Would I want my child to be taught or have a babysitter who's intoxicated? No. Would I want my pilot? No. Would I want my train engineer? No. Would I want the person on the highway coming towards me? No. I'm finding it hard to conjure up a job in which I would feel comfortable if the other person had marijuana on board.
Yeah, it's not going to improve. It doesn't improve anything, and there's a lot to process these days. You know, there's a lot. The world is complicated, and anything that dulls that just doesn't seem like a super smart idea.
Well, so much of our jobs are data entry, and look at some of that stuff is critical. And
yeah, you wonder how your name keeps getting misspelled on those name tags for.
There you go.
It's happening. Yeah. We have to take a really quick break. We'll be back with our guest, Dr. Bertha Madras. And that is all.
Down, never grow old. Tired of screwing up. Tired of going down. Tired of myself. Tired of this town. Oh, my. Oh, hell yes. Honey, put on that party dress. Buy me a drink. Sing me a song. Take me as I come, because I can't stay long.
Let's dance with Mary Jane. One more time to kill the pain.
So before we cut back into that, Kathy has a local announcement that I know we'll run out of time at the end.
Oh, thank you.
Cue the local announcement.
Yeah, April 22nd is National Drug Take Back Event. We will be in front of City Hall, Reading City Hall, 10 to 2, with Reading Police Department and some other agencies handing out information. Please come and dispose of your expired and unused medications free of charge.
Ta-da.
Can we bring our marijuana down there?
So don't flush it down the toilet?
Yeah, please don't.
Yeah.
Let's not put it in the landfill.
Yeah, let's not do that.
Let's not leave access for our teens to get their hands on it. Let's just.
Well, you know, let's face it, the dope growers have got so much chemical in the ground and everything. Yeah. You add to it, and we're going to see, we're going to start seeing people that aren't really human anymore.
And we do take vape pens and vape devices also, as long as you remove the battery.
So, Dr. Madras, we want you to understand that we live in an area of Northern California that is the epicenter and basically the beginning of illegal marijuana growing in mass amounts in the United States. And we've seen what it's done to our communities. It's literally destroyed our communities. But I wanted to come back to the risk of injury. And we've talked about youth, and when we know that it affects the pruning in the brain, let's talk about risk of injury to older adults, because we now have a population 50 to 80 plus that are now using cannabis. Could you discuss that and what the risks are for our society for that?
Yes. Well, could you hold one?
Sure. Yeah,
Are we talking stall for time?
Yeah.
So the thing that we have to remember is that cannabis does a few things to anyone. Under the influence, it can disturb thought, cognitive function, motor coordination, induced sleepiness, and all of these things are potentially as devastating or more so for the elderly, because they, as you age, your cognition, your ability to think, to compute, to calculate, to remember is compromised. And marijuana exaggerates that compromise. Your motor coordination, your balance is also reduced, and marijuana reduces your motor coordination.
Perfect.
A study was done recently in which people who were using marijuana as medicine in their past their 55 or so were compared with people at that age range who weren't using marijuana, and what they showed is severe compromised cognition, more severe than if they were not on the drug. So I think one has to caution elderly people that whatever troubles you may have in terms of the process of aging, this may make things worse. Now, of course, elderly people, some say that it relieves aches and pains. It enables them to sleep. There are a whole host of self-reports that claim that marijuana makes them feel better. And we have to recognize that some people use and get away with it. And some people use and claim they feel better. But again, until there are randomized controlled trials that really look at very large populations, these claims live in the domain of self-reports, anecdotes, and I would never dismiss a person who says they feel better. I would only wait until the science clarifies whether or not that is true on a population basis.
Yeah. Or is it just, I feel better because I can't tell?
Well, and you feel better because you're numb.
Yeah.
You exactly. Know, you don't care.
I feel like I feel better.
A man in California who is, who I've had some very interesting conversations with. I'm going to try very hard not to identify him. But he is a physician who has seen thousands of people with substance use and substance use disorders. And one day I asked him what he thought was the most dangerous drug he had ever encountered. And I said, I'm not going to define dangerous. Just give me just a simple reaction. And he said, I don't even have to think about it. It's marijuana.
Wow.
And I was shocked. I was expecting heroin. I was expecting cocaine or methamphetamine or hallucinogens, which could cause people to behave in acts that are very contrary to their normal personalities. And I said, marijuana, I did not expect that. Tell me why. And he said, because it is the drug of self-delusion. It is the most delusional drug I have ever seen with thousands of people. People recognize they have an addiction to heroin. They recognize that they have a problem with cocaine or with methamphetamine or with alcohol. But he said in the case of marijuana, these folks have no clue of what's happening to their brains, to their motivation, to their ability to think, to the fact that they can't live without the drug. And they will defend it and defend it despite all the objective data that shows that they are really compromised by the continued and heavy use. And I thought that was one of the most interesting comments I'd heard from a practicing physician.
And we hear it and see it every day here on the street, too, Dr. Madras. Could you tell us about your current research and what emerging research you think that you're going to be involved in the future? And what's the future for marijuana in our country, big picture?
Yeah. Well, there are three things that I can share with you. One is we are looking at this inflammation and I'll give you the brain region. It's called the amygdala. It's a region that is critical, as I said, for emotional reactions, for depression, for PTSD. Its network into the frontal cortex is critical for facial recognition, emotional recognition of faces. So it's a very key region, and we're trying to understand whether or not the effects persist, whether or not they can be opposed by using medications to prevent them from happening, and whether or not other brain regions, so far we haven't found it in other brain regions, but we haven't looked. We have 29 regions that we have prepared, and there could be others as well that are affected. So in terms of basic science, that is my current interest, including possibly developing ways of imaging it, imaging these changes in human brain to see whether or not we can detect it in adolescents and whether or not it disappears if the adolescent stops using. In terms of these so-called cultural research that I'm doing research on trying to understand how important the influence of parents are with respect to their child's drug use, and specifically marijuana use. And some of our data are really, really interesting on the influence of parents and what kind of messages they transmit to their children that could be protective or, in fact, could facilitate use. We already published the fact that parents who use marijuana, even lifetime use, not past year use, but lifetime use, parents who use marijuana, present or in the past, their children are much more likely to use marijuana and even opioids. So parents have a critical role in this, in protecting their youth, their adolescent children, and their adult children. And I think it's imperative for them to realize how critical they are in the process of children deciding whether or not to use or not to use. And the final thing that I'm engaged in right now is developing a course with the university on what parents can do to protect their children from drug use. It's going to be about 20 hours, and it's going to be multimedia, which means video clips and personal stories and a lot of other things. And hopefully it'll be completed within this year.
You know, the other thing, if you want to, and there's multiple targets in the target market, right, for education, but I honestly, so much of this policy is being driven by the people who may have been involved with the 2% THC in the 60s and 70s, and they see no harm in it because, well, the stoners at their high school grew up and got jobs, so obviously it doesn't hurt anybody, and it's better than alcohol and blah, blah, blah. You hear this all the time, and these are the policymakers who are bringing you know, the flood of dope stores to the towns, and approving commercial growing in our counties
with no checks and balances. This is what gets me. You know, we were promised here in the state of California, you know, we're going to have all these checks, you know, from seed to sell, and who's doing it? Nobody.
No.
And who's going into these pot shops and testing these products? You don't know what you're getting when you walk in there.
But they just don't see. They don't see
the harm.
They're not seeing the harm. And so a really important target market are the people that are legislating all this at the federal, state, county, and local level.
Well, I fully agree with that. I've been trying to educate legislators for years now.
God bless you.
In many capacities.
Yeah.
In fact, we just did a Zoom session with in conjunction with the Department of Education, and all we heard the feedback from people on the Zoom, there were over close to 800 people on it, was how do we prevent this? How do we protect our children? What is going on? Why can't we intervene? Why can't we stop this? There's no prevention. So the first thing I would say is, number one, prevention is a critical piece of drug policy. It is absolutely critical, and there is lip service, but very little being done on prevention at the state, the municipal, and at the federal level. And for that, I say shame, 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 because there is so little education of parents, of children, of teachers, of anyone engaged that wants to end this what I consider a looming disaster. That's number one. Number two is that legislators, we have to recognize that their agendas are driven in part by campaign finances and by influence of very wealthy concerned parties in this. And if we don't get to the root of who's paying for campaigns, who's accepting campaign financing, and who's promoting and advocating for this, and trying to develop lists of people, lists of industries that are doing this, and how they're pushing back, because their pushback strategies are really very clever. We're not going to get a handle on it. The legislators are going to listen to the people who knock on their offices and come in
with a check,
and in part help their finance their campaigns.
Yeah. Well, and it's such a large.
There are many people who claim that, first of all, nothing happens to them. Secondly, it's therapeutic. And thirdly, this is an alarmist campaign without a basis in fact. And there is no question some people can use, they can get away with it. Many people can use and not get away with any consequences. We have to be able to counter those personal tales and anecdotes with good science, and the science is not getting out the way it should.
No. Yep. It's there's no accident with that. The suppression is really calculated, I don't know that we'll ever fully understand that, but I think when the public weighs in and tells their elected officials that they expect them to make decisions based on science and benefit children, your information on kids is amazing. Dr. Bertha Madras has been with us the last couple hours, and if you do not send this show to a friend, you are committing malpractice. There you go. Radio malpractice. Thank you so much, Dr. Madras, for being with us.
Thank you, thank you.
You have been listening to We the People, and you can find this show at wethepeopleradio.us.
I'm having a ball. Don't stop me now. If you want to have a good time, just give me